Welcome to the Sherry Sylvester Show. We are taping live from the Texas Policy Summit here in 2024 on the University of Texas campus. I am joined today by Dr. Walter Wendler, who is the president of West Texas A&M University. Dr. Wendler came to West Texas University after being the chancellor at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. He graduated from Texas A&M, attended University of California at Berkeley, and has his PhD from the University of Texas. Dr. Wendler, thank you so much for being here today. We have been talking for the last hour about the impact of so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion on college campuses. And you said in our panel that you had closed down a DEI office at WT. What happened when you did that? Was there any blowback?
Sherry, first of all, thanks for having me. And on the closure of the DEI office, of course, we responded to the mandate that was provided by us, by the state legislature, and our board and our chancellor. The board and the chancellor said, this is what we need to do. The state said, this is what we're going to do. And we did it.
And what was the goal? Was it to, and the idea was to provide more outreach to minority students?
Well, I wasn't sure what the goal was of the legislature, other than they thought that these investments did not yield much fruit, as Senator Betancourt just said in the in our panel. And I believe that that's true. And what we're trying to do at WT is replace the identity group politics with a more general view of what it is that creates engaged citizens. As a public university, that's our charge, that's our mandate to actually create a stronger republic. And I think it's very important. And we're working at that now by not just emphasizing what traditionally the DEI offices have done, which is aspects of the African-American community, Hispanic community, the LGBT community, all important communities. But what we're doing is looking globally now at the idea of citizenship for all people. It's, you know, it affects everyone. And when public higher education works, it will create or help create stronger citizens. You know, we talk about education as a public good, but it's first a private good. Somebody pays for it, goes to school, learns a vocation and how to think critically and so on and so forth, hopefully. And when they do that, that's a direct benefit to them, but society benefits because that creates a stronger constitutional republic. So I think the elimination of the DEI offices has not hurt us at all. And we looked at the enrollment of various groups of people and so on, and over the last 10 years, it's changed very little. We have not had a significant impact to do what the DEI offices were actually intended to do.
You know, I'm really interested in the culture that DEI has created. I did a media interview yesterday, and opposite me to challenge me in supporting Senate Bill 17 and getting rid of DEI, some students at the University of Texas, one of them was quoted that we were getting rid of spaces. When she came to college, she expected spaces where she would be validated, accepted, and loved. And I believe that she believes that that can only be achieved through identity politics. It's that she has to have a space with people who look exactly like her. How did we get so, is that the secularization of academics? How did somebody get so off base? I wanted to say, well, I love you.
Right.
I'm commanded to.
Right, right, right. Me too. And that's, you know, I mentioned before, I think we are all made in the image of God. Every human being on the face of the earth is made in the image of God. And I believe that. And I tell people that. And I think we need to treat people that way with dignity and respect, each and every one as an individual. And I'm not sure the identity group politics actually allows that to happen, because we tend to pay the most attention to the loudest group. But the most strident minority is one, a minority of one. And we have to pay attention to that individual. And that's how people feel loved and feel safe and secure, I think. I'm not even sure what that means, to tell you the truth. I really don't know, Sherry.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important that we treat every person that puts a foot on the campus at West Texas A&M University, I want to treat those people as important and worthwhile and have great value to us and to the greater social order, because they do. And it's what makes our society function.
It's really interesting. It's as if there's so much passion, a lot of it hate-filled, coming out of that ideology. And I think that's why there's been such a backlash to it. And I felt so hopeful in the learning about the establishment of the Hill Institute at WT and what Dr. Justin Dyer was talking about, the Civitas Institute and Dr. Polyakov. If students could get back to real debate on campus, nothing's more fun than debating with somebody who absolutely disagrees with you.
Sure. And I think we've, I don't know if our intention is to protect people from things they don't want to hear. I'm not sure what it is, but I think the problem is we need to be intellectually tough and rational and thoughtful about the positions we take. And that's the problem with so many ideologies. People don't even understand where the ideology comes from or what it's about. I mean, it's a problem. And I think that's why I think importantly, core curricula can help students do that. It starts long before that. It starts in the home. It starts in places of worship and so on and so forth. But I think the idea that every person deserves to be treated with dignity and respect is absolutely critical. Absolutely critical.
It is interesting. What have you seen on campus? You talk about identity political groups being a small groups with loud megaphones. What happens to students outside those groups?
Well, I think at WT, because of the nature of it, our students actually find ways to get engaged in the campus through things, clubs and organizations, campus ministries. Our campus is surrounded with various ministerial organizations, and people engage those, and they find a way to create a cultural experience, an emotional experience, and an intellectual experience. For me, one of the things that concerns me is that we in some ways ask students to check their faith life at the campus gate. And I don't think that's a good idea. I think we need to encourage students to bring their faith life with them into the campus and use that to inform their intellectual life and vice versa. I think a blind adherence to either the mind or the heart is not a good idea. I think it needs to be balanced, and I think that's what we try to model for our students at WT. And by the way, we're not perfect at it. We're struggling with it. We're working to find a way to do it because it is so far out of the mainstream of our society today, both on campus and off campus. People just stay away from things that create consternation or, that start an argument. And I think we need not be afraid of that.
You know, I'm interested. You and I have never talked about this before, but one of the other goals that we have and have had for decades at TPPF is to close the gap, between white students and minority students. That's the whole purpose of our school choice initiative, because we want every kid to be in a school that would best serve them. But and we also argue that you can't suddenly fix that at the college level.
No.
But as an educator, what kinds of things would you put in place?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do, for example, we have a goal, and it's right now it's a soft goal, but it's the direction we're going. We want to be the most homeschool-friendly university in the state of Texas, and we are working with the Texas Homeschool Coalition to find ways to be to welcome and integrate homeschool students into the college campus. And by the way, part of this is selfish on my part. The fact of the matter is homeschool students actually perform better than do students from the general population, and they perform better on standardized tests. Their GPAs are higher after the freshman year, and the freshman to sophomore retention rate, which is very important in university life, is higher. And that's not me saying that. That is the fact of homeschool. Plus, the number of homeschool students is continuing to rise. It's somewhere between 7 and 10% of the high school graduates in Texas last year were homeschool students. So we want to be appealing to those students. It's hard for us to compete with the bigs, you know, with Texas A&M, my alma mater, the University of Texas, my other alma mater. Uh-huh. Those are very difficult schools because they're big, you know, the beautiful campuses. We have a beautiful campus, too. But there's so much attractive about those big schools. And we want to find ways to compete by looking at niches where students are coming from that we think will make good students. And Sherry, for me, I want the students that we bring into WT to actually affect the university. I want the students to help make WT a better university. We always seem to think that's the job of the faculty and the administration and so on. It's the job of the students, too. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring in tough-minded students who work hard, who challenge, you know, who challenge each other in their thought processes. This is absolutely critical to me. Uh-huh. And I think it's what a good university does.
Yeah. And of course, homeschooling in the last year has just skyrocketed among minorities.
Oh, I know. I know. I saw the data from Atlanta, the city of Atlanta, and it is amazing how many African-American families are homeschooling students now. And, what we get on the 6 o'clock news doesn't tell that story.
No.
And it's a very important story. A very important story.
Well, you talk about competing with the bigs, and I think we forget that universities are competitive and that we're currently dealing with a lot of enrollment declines.
Yes, ma'am.
What do you think the cause of that? I mean, people look at me and say, well, it's DEI. I'm not sure it is DEI. I think it may be a lot of other things going on in the culture.
I think there's a lot of things. First, if you watch the news or read the paper, there's this constant reminder that universities may not be doing a very good job of producing employment-ready graduates. And when push comes to shove, people come to college because they want a better life experience, which includes a good job with a decent salary and so on and so forth. That's reason number one. Reason number two, the birth rate is declining. I mean, we're just not producing as many babies as we used to. Texas does a pretty good job, but that's why South Carolina and Alabama and Mississippi and Oklahoma, they're all over in Texas recruiting Texas students because we are still producing students. And I think if I didn't lose count, number four is that the college readiness of many high school graduates is not what it used to be. I think when Rick Perry was governor, he instituted a policy whereby the default curriculum was a college prep curriculum and a student could opt out of it into a general academic curriculum. And for a lot of first-gen families and so on, that was a good message because it said, look, if your student, son or daughter, takes these courses, they'll be more likely to be college ready than if they took the general preparation. So I think there's a number of factors. And of course, I think some people just think that the universities have sort of abandoned the basic mission. You know, they don't talk about patriotism and family and, the value of a community and trust and the basic values, I think, is we have to pay attention to that.
It's really interesting. I was on a panel, a media group panel, and they were talking about Gen Z's not voting, and they did some polling of them, and a big chunk, 30-40% of Generation Z's, felt that they were not informed enough to vote.
See, and that's a very sad thing, and that's where we talked about courses in history, courses in government, state and local government, national government, those courses are important because you don't have to be a rocket scientist to have a good idea about certain pieces of legislation. There are some that are complicated, but many of them, just with a good reading knowledge of the issues, you can make an intelligent choice about what you think is best, but not if it's never encouraged in the university. And unfortunately, I fear in too many high schools, it's not encouraged either. I mean, I've seen some of these test questions that they give to high schools, and sometimes I think it's stuff that's made up for the internet, you know, but they'll ask ask a student or a group of students, when was the War of 1812? And half of them get it wrong, you know, that kind of thing. It's I think it's ludicrous. But the fact of the matter is, I think the basics in history and political science, we are neglecting those at our peril. I think it's a terrible mistake because I don't think we're creating people that can participate as informed citizens. And that's, you know, the founding fathers all talked about how important education was. And it hasn't changed. I mean, it's still important.
Well, and in Texas, we have no excuse. It's actually, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, you may be, but in Texas, every high school principal is a deputy registrar. And if there are kids in his or her school that are 18, it is their responsibility to make sure they register. And I believe that's one of the reasons why, one of the things that the percentage of people that vote is so low, because anybody that's 18 in high school has to register to vote. So all those people are registered.
But then they don't vote.
But then because 40% of them don't feel prepared.
I didn't know that, Cherry. That's an interesting statement.
I just learned it. I'm telling everyone because I didn't.
That's interesting.
The law was made in the 50s.
Isn't that interesting? But there again, that would come out of a course in political science, you know, an introductory course,
right,
even in high school.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a great teachable moment. Why are we encouraging you to register to vote? Why do we do that? Because
right.
You can make a difference.
Right.
And I think that's, for me, that's engaged citizenship.
Yeah, or even if you're just one of these people that's walking around boiling mad.
Right.
That's a place that you can mark it down.
Count
me as a no.
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, it's true. I feel that way when I walk into the polls. I'm getting a chance to cast, and I never feel like that's a waste of time. I never feel like it's a fool's errand. It's important for me to go there and do it. Maybe more for me than anyone else. I'm not sure how often my vote would make a difference, but it's important to me because I had a chance to express my thoughts and opinions about something, and I took it. And I think that's very important. And that's part of this thing about patriotism. Patriotism is it's undervalued in contemporary society, I think. People are afraid of it. If you're too patriotic, somebody will say, well, he's a Christian nationalist, you know. I've been accused of that myself. And the fact of the matter is, I'm an informed, what Reagan called, an informed patriot. I mean, I consider myself that. And I think we need more of that rather than less of it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I interviewed a guy on the show not too long ago. He'd written a book called The City on a Hill. He was a Massachusetts guy and had ideas about education reform. And he said, we were talking about voting, he said, I live in Massachusetts. And he said, I'm a conservative. He said, so my vote doesn't matter, but it matters that I vote.
Yes, there you have it.
I thought that was quite lovely putting it.
Yeah, it's a nice way to put it.
Well, to close us out a little bit, there was a lot of debate in a panel earlier today on wokeness on college campuses about where all this started. You and I are kind of in the same age group. I remember this on campus. This doesn't feel new to me. I know that there was a burst in 2020 after the George Floyd murder.
Right.
But this push, this ideology, this identity politics, race, the race-based view of the world, this is not new. You've lived most of your life on campus.
I have.
How did you see this evolve?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I graduated Texas A&M in 1972, so uh-huh. I am really an old Aggie. It's not a figure of
but
speech.
But not the oldest in the group.
No, not the oldest in the group. But and when I went from Texas A&M as an undergraduate to Berkeley in a Master of Architecture program,
wow,
it was like I had been in against the gutter on one side of the road and then went to the other side of the road. But it helped me find my sort of the double stripes down the middle of the road. It helped me understand where I was, and it was very valuable. But I saw pretty dramatically in the early 70s at Berkeley this sort of, I wouldn't call it woke, but it was a sort of campus activism, you know, that was, and that's turned into something else. It was, I thought as campus activism, it made some kind of sense about the war and so on and so forth. You know, it was a legitimate perspective. I didn't buy it at Berkeley.
Right.
I was still an Aggie at heart when I
was there. Marches against the war in Vietnam.
Yeah,
example.
There was some. It was a particular purpose.
Right.
And
yeah.
it didn't know any. There was no identity group within that. I don't think. I mean, it was young men were going off and fighting a war, and people weren't sure what it was about. But then it evolved over time, and it's become so personal. I mean, now we have people, you know, the identity, how we identify ourselves. And for example, it's perfectly fine for somebody to identify themselves in one way. Not so fine if I identify myself, for example, as a Christian. People don't like to hear that. They say, no, that's not right. But that is, in fact, how I see myself.
Uh-huh.
And I'm honest about it. I don't try to get other people to necessarily, I'm not proselytizing. It's not my goal to try to convince someone else that this is the right way to live. My goal, though, is to be transparent and honest with people that I talk with so they know what my bias is, where I'm coming from. I'll call it a bias. They can say, well, yeah, you see everything through God's word, for example. Well, I do. I mean, I can't apologize for it. It's how I see things. Now let's talk about the issue. Whatever the issue is, if the issue is green energy, we'll talk about it. I'm telling you, I'm coming at it from a different view than you might be if you believe something else. I think it's perfectly fine to have those discussions. And I think in some ways we have push that away from the center of the campus so we all have to agree on something and there's a standard. That's what we're talking about when some of the schools have the DEI statements, you know. I mean, that is basically trying to institutionalize or memorialize a particular point of view. And I don't think it's right. I think we need to be open to all points of view on a university campus.
And it creates kind of a vacuum because people don't know what they're against.
Exactly.
I mean, I have so many arguments with people about the issues that are incendiary issues, you know, social issues, energy issues, issues of economics and poverty. And they're always enlightened because they don't know the conservative argument.
Right. Well, and it's like Senator Betancourt said, that, you know, that there were people that were, I think it was over here at UT, they were, you know, talking about from the river to the sea, and they didn't know what river or what sea. And that's like when the War of 1812 was. You have to know what river and what sea, or the discussions don't make any sense.
Right.
And where you fall on with the propriety of any views on that is up for a lot of discussion, obviously, and debate. And I have a very strong opinion what I think is right. But you got to know what river you're talking about and the sea that you're talking about and why those two geological features are important. I mean, it's part of our history in Western culture.
Yes. And it's a very long, long history.
It is a long history.
And if you're kind of shy away from that Bible book, you're going to miss a chunk of that history.
Yeah. 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 And we can't even talk about it. I was accused I quoted the Bible. You know, I talk about one of the things I talk about at WT is that I want to treat everybody by using the golden rule. I want to treat people the way I want to be treated. And people push back. And I said, look, that's the law of reciprocity. It exists in every known religion in the world. There's not a single religion, not Buddhism, not Confucianism, not Hinduism, none of them, not Islam, none of them deny the importance of the golden rule, of the law of reciprocity. But they don't want to talk about it that way. Somebody told me, you're not teaching a Sunday school class here. This is a public university. I said, okay, let's just call it the law of reciprocity and be done with it. Now let's have a discussion. Do you think in financial aid or in some administrative office on the campus that we shouldn't treat students with dignity and respect? I'm just making that up. We do, I think, do a good job. But the bottom line is, that is what's critical, I think, at a good university. Treat every person as a worthy individual.
And you can,
or don't accept them. Don't bring them into the university. If you can't do that, then something else is wrong.
And you need, you know who you can serve and who can succeed.
Yes. Yes, there are a lot of indicators. Some people don't like standardized tests. You know, I implemented the policy at WT about 5 years ago now, and I don't want to take too much time with this description, but basically we call it the Principal Scholars Program. And if a principal from any school in the top 46 counties of Texas, or from any 1A or 2A school anywhere across Texas, across the state, recommends a student to us we will take that student. They don't have to apply or anything else. We trust the principals because the principals know these kids, especially in these small rural schools. Now, they don't at Houston ISD, for example. There's just too many kids. But the fact of the matter is we have picked up a lot of recommendations, thousands, not quite 2,000 yet, but principals take it seriously. And it puts a burden on the student to perform because the principal has stood behind them, somebody that they know from. I was at schools, Sherry, up in the Panhandle, where the principal had been in every house of every student, and he knew who the deadbeat dads were. He knew who where the mothers were working hard and the father's not doing anything, or vice versa. He knew where the kids had to go out and work almost full time, and he knew a lot about the families. He or she, and when they make the recommendation, they take all that in, and it's been, we've had out of 2,000 recommendations, I think it's over 2,000 now, one time we had to say no, one time.
Another terrific idea from Dr. Walter Wendler at West Texas A&M. Walter, thank you so much for joining us today on the Sherry Sylvester Show. You can watch this podcast on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to receive my newsletter, you can sign up at 9th and Congress, www.texaspolicy.com/9thandcongress.